you had a particular chassis that had a vertical rolling problem in Staten Island only. And it wound up, we found out what the problem was, but all of those sets, it was a DO3 chassis, had to be replaced. Amazing what they went through.
And I have a response to that. Yeah, with the power in Staten Island, I know there were certain places in the five boroughs where you don't have what I call one-phase power. In my case, there's three phases of distribution going down the street, phase A, B, and C, and I think I'm on phase B, and my pole pick transformer gives me 240 volts center tap. So the two phases, the red and the black phase, are really 180 degrees out of phase, 120 volts each. So I'm really getting one single phase. But I believe portions of Brooklyn, portions of Queens, and I think portions of Staten Island are wired differently. Was that a contributing factor to the problem you ran into, John? Go ahead.
No, when we measured our frequency here, it was 59.7. It was right on the money. And because we actually tried to take it to other boroughs, and sometimes they would work in that borough. The person would have no trouble at all. But on Staten Island, and the whole problem was when we looked at the vertical sync pulse, there was noise in that pulse that was not being taken out, and it would cause the noise blanker to trip out and cause the set to roll. It would drive you out of your mind. It took us a while to figure that one out.
But what was unique about Staten Island that made it happen there as opposed to nowhere else?
QIQ.
I believe, Dick, it was the amount of signal that was generally available. Some people had it, some people did not. Very strange. We made about 7 trips to Batavia up near Buffalo, New York, for this problem.
Go ahead, Glenn.
An interesting thing with certain power companies are, and I know Staten Island was one area with Con Edison where they had experimented with this for a while, and I think this was a common thing in the 60s, and eventually all the transformers, eventually the line transformers became more uniform. But what was happening is they ran transformers closer into voltage saturation, and what was really happening was if you looked at the waveform that was coming out of them, there was so much noise that was coming out of the transformers that actually really caused a problem. And I have heard of that. That was a problem from what I understand in the 60s in Staten Island. In some other areas of Con Ed where they were experimenting with using transformers closer to higher levels of saturation. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I can tell you why that happened, too.
For the spectrum analyzers that I was buying and building. I was building spectrum analyzers. I was the engineering manager of spectrum analyzer products for a while at Airborne Instruments Laboratory in roughly 1971, 72. And we were buying a transformer from a company in New Jersey that went to brand X when it comes to the EI laminations. Therefore, although the transformer worked okay on 60 hertz, it saturated much too soon, and on 50 hertz, the people in Japan, for instance, boy, were they running into grief with that transformer. I'm going to guess that the transformers that were being built for Con Ed or Loco or LIPA, they maybe had an exact design of the transformer, but maybe didn't use tight enough quality control on the kind of iron that was going in the transformer. And if you use cheap enough iron, it saturates too soon and therefore gives you a lot of harmonic energy. Is that approximately what could have been happening here, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I think if I remember the story correctly, how what had actually happened was, you're right about that, but it wasn't frequency. It was actually voltage. It was primary voltage that was being used in Staten Island. And to increase efficiency, they moved the voltage up. And on the primary winding, they didn't readjust. I think the primary voltage went from 2.1 kV to 2.4. And what happened was they basically the turns ratio they corrected, but they didn't correct the saturation characteristic of the transformer. I think John might have more insight on this one as well. Back to you, Dick, first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Hey, you got it, John. Wait for the beep, John.
Yes, Dick. What had happened out here, Glenn is right, they did raise the voltage, but because of the rapid expansion out here, they were building houses like crazy at that time. Because we were a desolate borough. they just changed the taps on the transformers to adjust for it. But the higher end current did not work out on the transformers. Now, I'm going to tell you what Edison writes their own paper. They're self-insured. They can do whatever they want. You can't do a lot of things. Electricians can't do things. But Edison can do whatever they want. They changed the labels on the transformers. How does that help? I wonder about that. But that was the reason the transformers started acting up, because of the expansion and the tap changing. They tried to compensate. They just wouldn't do it.
Business sometimes, and profit margins and whatever. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Yeah, the original question was if the maximum deflection of electrons would be negligible. So I think the right response would be that actually it is not negligible, and I can recall that the force experienced by the electrons was FEB, let me put it this way. The force of acceleration experienced by the electrons are actually radial. As the electron travels a circular path in a constant magnetic field, but the force and acceleration act downward over the short distance of the screen. So let's say the screen is 20 centimeters from the exit of the electron guns. So the time of electron takes to travel distance is, if I recall correctly, I was expressing about 3.6 millimeters. So it is not negligible. But if you think, but of course, if the monitor were turned to the 180 degrees, the deflection would be upward. Or if the electrons travel parallel or anti-parallel to the Earth magnetic field, then there would be no deflection. So the actual deflection depends on relative orientation of the monitor or and the Earth field. So I believe that clearly for this effect is elimination of the real, application.
In the case of the Earth's magnetic field, everyone believes that magnetic field is parallel to the Earth. It's not. If you own a Hall effect device and you orient it for the strongest Earth's magnetic field at roughly 450 milligauss, that's what it was back in the days when I was measuring it in 1972, 73. I think it's gone down a little bit since then. That Earth's magnetic field vector, as I very remember, it was tilted down at a 30 degree angle from horizontal in Farmingdale, where I was making the measurement. So there's a complicated vector of that Earth's magnetic field, and depending on the accuracy of what you need on these electrons that are being deflected, that Earth's magnetic field is something that you might have to null out by external coils. Was that John that wanted to say something? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
In NMR, it has to be accounted for. But in electrostatic deflection, if you look at a CRT and rotate the equipment, you will not see that dot move in the magnetic field of the Earth. It won't affect it that way.
I wonder why. In the case of a magnetically deflected gun assembly, the ferrite type yoke, I think part of what's going on here is the accuracy requirement for purity, the red, green, blue color purity. So that's what I think it is. So the actual amount of deflection is fairly small, but it affects purity. And I was guessing that it affected convergence, and John was telling us almost no effect on convergence, only color purity, because I presume the beam for the red, the beam for the green, and the green for the blue, beam for the blue, have to go through a very small aperture and have to be carefully aligned in order to make everything else work right, and so therefore high accuracy is required.
Let me correct that, Dick.
All right, go ahead, John.
The electron beam was not being deflected. It was being deflected from the magnetic contamination of the shadow mask, which is that metal plate with the apertures behind the faceplate of the CRT. That's what was causing the purity problem. It had nothing to do with the Earth's magnetic field deflecting the beams. It was contaminating the shadow mask, which was causing the magnetic effect on the electrons.
Yeah, now I'm beginning to remember a little bit more about it. There's a kind of a triangular geometry. The beam from red, green, and blue coming through three separate gun assemblies on the neck of the cathode ray tube, those three beams come from three slightly different locations in the vicinity of the gun at the back of the tube. They, in turn, go through a mask that's got a whole lot of triangular displaced holes. And after each one of those beams goes through the shadow mask hole, that beam with that particular spotting location, therefore that particular trajectory, the beam therefore goes through the shadow mask hole, and hopefully the red beam only hits the red dots, and the green beam only hits the green dots on the phosphor screen. Red, green, and blue dots are set out in triangular patterns, and they all have to be carefully aligned compared to the holes of that shadow mask. So the overall trajectory gets changed by the Earth's magnetic field, and therefore it goes through that shadow mask at a slightly wrong angle, and therefore it starts hitting the wrong phosphor dots on the screen out front. Is that approximately it, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
You got it exactly right, Dick. In fact, if the convergence, if the purity could be set slightly out of line or defocusing the electron beam, it would strike a broader pattern on the aperture mask, and it would cause heating, and it would warp it. And sometimes when it cooled down, when you did it right, if you converged it, it would come back. But sometimes it would warp it so much, you could not get the purity back. So there was a lot of different combinations in those things.
Yeah, I can see. What's really going on there, John, is that if you have a poorly focused beam, which doesn't hit the holes precisely, you therefore are having a broader beam where more of it is hitting the shadow mask and not hitting the holes. Therefore, you're going to get a dimmer picture. That the user of the set compensates by turning the brightness higher. Now, the brightness higher means a total number of electrons hitting the shadow mask is greater. Therefore, more heating takes place. Is that approximately it, John? Go ahead.
You got it. Exactly right. The more they impinged on that mask, the more heat it would develop. So it was a critical balance. You had to have it right.
You got it, Wes. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, well, since John mentioned nuclear magnetic resonance, I would like to make a comment in this area of resonant amplification of magnetic domain well motion by a train of current pulses. The current induced motion of magnetic domain walls confined to nanostructure is of interest for the application in magnetoelectronic devices in which the domain wall serves as the logic gate or memory element. The injection of the spin polarized current below the threshold value potential results in its pre-sessional motion within the potential wheel. It could be shown that by using a short train of current pulses, those length and spacing are tuned to this precession frequency, and the domain wall's oscillation can be resonantly amplified. So this makes possible for the motion of the domain walls, which with much reduced current, more than five times smaller than in the absence of the resonance amplification. If that makes some sense, Glenn and John?
Glenn?
John?
No, you don't. Dick?
Boy. Frank? I think, Wesley, You made a statement, and maybe there was a question in there, and I'm not sure. But I think you're going the next step now, where in theory, I guess, there are ways of storing data on a disk, a magnetic disk, which can use some of these characteristics and get extremely high data densities. I mean, the amount of data we're putting on hard drives these days is just out of sight compared to what happened 20 years ago. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
The real application that I have, and I'm very glad that Glenn is here with us, there is a ferrite ring that is made up of out of two halves. Is taken from the deflection yoke. The primary winding is, let's say, 15 winds, and is connected to the generator. Now, the frequency that we're dealing here is approximately 50 hertz, and it's a ramp shape. Now, on the secondary, we have 150 winds of PFLR, and then we have a capacitor connected to it in parallel. And then we have a load, whatever load. It's not big impedance on it, say 20 ohms. Now, what I understood is that, let me jump, that when we tune that capacitor, we're changing the impedance on 60 winds or 15 winds. And then, if we have any mismatch of the impedance between 50 ohms of the output of the generator, then we are able, simply by using this capacitor, to change the output, the input coil impedance to match more closely to 50 ohms. I would like to confirm that. And then the second thing would be, I'm going to put the spacing of the thin paper between two halves. So I'm trying to break somehow the integrity of the magnetic flux. What would then happen? Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to make some guesses, and then I'm going to pass it over to Glenn for a confirmation on this. Making the primary winding or the secondary winding have an impedance of 50 ohms might not be required, because most of the instrumentation we use in the United States, spectrum analyzers and network analyzers and whatever, are referenced to 50 ohms. Yes, there is a strong motivation to make circuits come out 50 ohms, but there are times if it's the matching of the input gate of a power transistor, an RF power transistor, you can come up with some very different impedances. When you create a air gap between the two halves of that yoke ferrite assembly that used to be part of the deflection circuit of a cathode ray tube, let me drop. As you add strips of thin paper between those two halves, a number of things are going to happen. Number one, the total primary inductance will go down, because the total curved circuit around the perimeter of that ferrite, the whole circuit, magnetic circuit inductance, reluctance, is going to increase. So the primary inductance is going to go down. The secondary inductance is going to go down. The coupling between the primary and the secondary is going to slightly decrease. The amount of leakage reactance between primary and secondary is going to increase. So a number of factors are going to change simultaneously. The impedance you see on the primary, because of lower inductance and a different amount of leakage reactance, it will be a brand new impedance. That could be better. There may be a magic number for the gap that gives you the desirable frequencies of operation. I know that I've looked at a couple of those videos, and I can tell that there are multiple frequencies of operation that you want to hit resonance on simultaneously to get this particular effect. So I made some guesses as to what that air gap is going to do. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Jeff, Glenn.
Yeah, up very good, Dick, and you're right on as far as the primary impedance goes. In other words, basically, primary impedance is not so much determined by the loading factor of the transformer. That's basically just loading impedance back to the primary, but basically the primary impedance is in a voltage-fed transformer is determined by the generator. And in most cases, in those high-voltage generators, your impedance, load impedance, is basically less than 10 ohms. In other words, it's very, very low because it's a very, very staunchy voltage source driving that winding. Now, as you had mentioned, Dick, exactly, as you increase the gap, the primary inductance is basically going down, as is all the inductances on all of the windings. So when that happens, magnetization current increases. And what does that really mean? Magnetization current is current that gets trapped between the generator and the primary winding that never couples to the secondary. In other words, if you look at the turns ratio from primary to secondary, and you have an additional magnetization current due to a low inductance on the primary, that current gets trapped in the primary. Let me let this drop for a second. So by basically increasing that air gap, yes, it's true the inductance goes down. Yes, you're going to get a little bit more magnetization current in the primary, but there's also a benefit. By increasing that air gap between the ferrite, what's basically happening is you're lowering the overall permeability because the inductance is dropping. And when that's happening, that allows the transformer to go, basically it becomes more saturation tolerant, meaning that you can have a little bit of offset DC on the core and not have that inductance collapse on its own. So if you have a circuit where you're tuning a capacitor on one of the secondary windings and you're creating a reactive loading on the transformer, there could be a possibility that you could be driving the transformer close to saturation. A little bit of air gap inside there will definitely help that out. The other thing, too, is one of the things to be wary about is that, you know, having resonance on a transformer, having resonance on any one of the windings will also drive the transformer into saturation and cause excessive heating. I think I'm going to drop it there for now, and then I'm going to hand it back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm sorry, is it possible that we may be creating a magnetic polarization at that point? 10 volts, 0.2 amps?
I don't think John or I, Glenn or I, quite understood that question. If your signal generator is a transistor that is conducting only in one direction, it's a single core transistor as opposed to an H-bridge that can drive it into two directions, then you've got a kind of built-in bias to your driving circuitry which will tend to saturate the transformer in one direction. And by putting in the air gap, I'm pretty sure Glenn is saying that you'll be pulling it out of that saturation. That's one piece of good news. A more superior signal generator would be an H-bridge, which can drive it in a bipolar manner. And therefore, if you can make the waveform of the generator be a symmetric waveform where there is the same amount of area above 0 volts and area below 0 volts, then you're not creating a DC component that creates saturation. Then, in that case, if you had a symmetric generator, if you had a symmetric generator which doesn't have a bias to it where it tends to saturate in one direction, then I think the best way to operate the yoke assembly would be with no air gap, because with no air gap, the total reluctance of the path is lower, the total amount of magnetic field capable of that core is higher, therefore the total amount of stored magnetic energy could be greater. As you start adding more and more air gap, I think the total amount of stored magnetic energy must go down. Is that approximately true, Gunn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Energy stored in magnetic materials basically always never gets stored in the high permeability area. It always gets stored into the low permeability area. So basically, if energy is going to be stored, in other words, normally the magnetic material wants to reset on each cycle, like you said. But what will happen is by having an air gap, you can actually have stored energy in the air gap, so that basically if you have a DC offset or bias or a peak voltage that goes higher than the saturation flux capability of the transformer. In other words, the number of turns versus the number of volts in cross-sectional area. If you exceed that during any period of time, you can store that energy temporarily inside the air gap, and then the transformer won't saturate and then recover on the next cycle. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick. Kate's where I said you. KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, I'm about to ask you a question where I can see there's two answers, and the two answers fight each other, so I'm going to have you try to identify which is which. In earlier discussions tonight, you and I agreed that as we add an air gap in the two halves of the ferrite core of this yoke assembly, the total inductance of the primary and total inductance of the secondary decreases. Now, if I describe stored magnetic energy in joules as one-half Li squared, and if L is going down because of the air gap, it would at first suggest that the same amount of current is going to create a lower amount of stored energy in joules when there's a bigger air gap. It would suggest that, but there's another catch going on here, and that is I will reach that higher current sooner if I'm putting in a ramp voltage, if I have a lower inductance. And therefore, the I might be bigger, and one-half Li squared might still be the same amount of magnetic stored energy. I'm wondering now, if I'm using the transformer in the most ideal manner, where I'm not putting in a biased current, I've got a real symmetric H-bridge. Let me drive. If I got a real symmetric H-bridge, and now the only thing that limits the amount of stored magnetic energy is whether or not each individual half of the yoke is itself saturated. I'm beginning to think there's a slim possibility that if I'm using the circuitry correctly with a symmetric H-bridge, that even with the air gap, the total amount of stored magnetic energy might be a wash. Otherwise, I see something else going on here. If I take it to the ridiculous extreme, where I make the air gap so big that now the secondary winding is not there anymore, I've got only the primary winding, the total amount of magnetic material active in the circuit is lower. Therefore, I think the total stored magnetic energy is lower. So I'm slowly coming to the conclusion that total amount of kickback energy capable usually goes down as I add an air gap. But I'm not positive, but I think that might be true. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, if one looks at a voltage transformer, in other words, a voltage transformer being defined as a low impedance voltage source driving a transformer, and you increase the air gap in that transformer, basically what's happening is the inductance on the primary is dropping. The magnetization current in the primary is increasing. So not only do you have the loading current, but you have higher magnetization current. The secondary never sees that magnetization current. The core itself really doesn't care, because as long as the energy and duty cycle is being reset on each cycle, the ferrite material really doesn't care. The only thing that really creates saturation is when the volt seconds are increasing. So in other words, as volt seconds increase, then you start storing more energy. So you have to think of the higher energy or peak flux intensity is volt seconds. Primary current doesn't really matter that much in the equation. If you follow what I'm saying, Dick, maybe that makes a little bit more sense. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, but I think I see a problem. Assuming now that I designed this primary-secondary transformer as an energy transfer device between primary and secondary, and I started off with the design with the two halves of the yoke slapped up against each other with no air gap, and I've now got a constant voltage driver. As I create more and more air gap and the primary inductance decreases, the same amount of driving voltage is going to create a lower inductance on the primary, a higher amount of magnetization current, and I think that higher amount of magnetization current is going to be pushing me towards saturation sooner, and I think the total network is going to develop a higher amount of harmonic energy, if I was driving it with a sine wave, as I create the air gap. I think the harmonic energy increases with the air gap as the primary inductive current increases. Does that sound about right, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Boy, Dick, I finally get to say this. It sounds like it would, but it really isn't. That's normally something you're saying to me. Actually, what happens is primary magnetization current basically is circulatory inside the primary, between the voltage source and the primary winding. As I said, the magnetic material really doesn't care. It really never sees it. If that inductance starts dropping, yes, you're going to have higher primary circulation currents, but the transformer, as far as the other windings are concerned, the magnetic material, it really doesn't care. It never sees it. There's no saturation at all. What basically happens is because the voltage impedance of the primary driver or the voltage source itself is so low, it just circulates and resets the current on every cycle. So basically what's happening is not only does it have the initial current to drive the load, but it has to drive more current to basically to supply or overcome the magnetization inductance. But that's all in the primary loop between the primary winding. Will the primary winding get hotter and more copper losses in the primary winding? Absolutely. As far as the coupling factor between the first winding, the primary, and the secondary, really very, very little effect on that. It just basically means that you've got to basically drive a lot more circulating currents inside the primary winding and have more copper losses in the primary winding. But basically the core, one way or the other, really doesn't care. As a matter of fact, it gets further and further away from saturation, because if you look at the volt seconds across across each winding, it's basically the same. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, once again, I'm beginning to see there's a large number of variables involved when it comes to a transformer design, and I can see why so few electronic engineers feel comfortable with transformer designs. My guess is in your career, you've met a lot of engineers who are pretty smart about almost everything except transformers, and a lot of them have trouble with transformers. Now, one of the things I think is true, and see if you would agree with me on this one, if Wesley had some kind of a very fine vernier circuit of some kind, mechanical circuit, such that as he turns the knob, he is very slowly changing the air gap on these two halves of his yoke. I think he could, if he wanted to, use that as a method of tuning at least one, if not more, of the resonant frequencies of this network of his. Does that sound reasonable? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, in resonance in a transformer is a kind of a sneaky and spooky thing. In order to determine the true resonant frequency in a transformer with a parallel capacitor, what you have to do is you have to short out the primary winding, determine the leakage inductance between the windings, and model it as a series inductance in series with the parallel capacitor to the winding. Now you've got a series LC network at that point. That's the resonant network right there. And of course the Q would be whatever the loading factor of the load is in parallel to the capacitor. The bad news is, if you hit a resonant frequency anywhere near the driving power supply, whatever's driving the primary winding, if you get close to anywhere near that frequency in terms of resonance, the transformer will go into saturation, because what's basically happening there is that the volts and amperes go to maximum across the windings. So you could have a voltage generated across the secondary winding greater than the primary, even though it's a step-down transformer. In resonance, you can have that capability where the secondary will actually drive the core into saturation because you've increased the volt seconds on the secondary greater than the primary. Just like it's hard to envision that you have higher primary current that doesn't have an effect on the secondary, if you have a resonance on the secondary winding, basically, those volt seconds wind up across the core and can saturate it. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, one of the things I think Wes is going to want to know is that if this resonance allows the secondary voltage to build to a higher number, can he use that as a desirable effect for what he is seeking? Over to you, Glenn.
I would say in terms of the transformer design, as a transformer designer, I don't see any good reason why you would want to do that to the transformer. So if there's a benefit, it's not in the transformer. If there's a spark gap somewhere in between that's adjusting the Q factor, so in other words, if the spark gap isn't built up and the Q of the circuit is in one area, so he tunes that capacitor and gets a very, very high voltage built up across that resonant secondary winding, he can get a very, very large voltage build up, and before the transformer saturates, the spark gap fires, detunes the Q, brings the transformer out of saturation, and the transformer never gets hot. But he is transferring energy through the spark gap. So I think it's really the spark gap here that could be the key, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
I'm going to pass it to you in a second now, Wes. That spark gap, when it does occur, is an extremely strong negative impedance. You're already getting a kind of nonlinearity going on between primary and secondary because of resonance. You add to that a spark gap that has now arced over, and it itself is a high negative impedance. Can you imagine trying to set up the proper equations for this nonlinear transfer? Over to you, Glenn.
It's not going to be easy, Dick, that's for sure. That's what I'm saying. In other words, when your original comment to me was, what's the benefit to the transformer? Did I see one? And I was like, no, I don't see it there. But certainly, I can understand that if the loading factor has an effect on the resonant Q, and that's just a trimming capacitor, he could theoretically create the secondary resonance, fire the spark gap, and then bring the transformer out of saturation again, where it's just a temporary loading as opposed to saturation. Saturation on a transformer is wicked. I mean, you know, resonance in a transformer that causes saturation is wicked. If this happens in a power system, everything goes on fire. Even though the spark gap might be a very, very hard negative impedance, just the fact that it pulls that saturation might save the whole system, if you know what I'm saying. So it's tricky, to say the at best. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Now, there was a 150 ampere 5 volt power supply voltage regulator system fed with 3-phase 400 cycle power that I worked on 20 years ago, and every so often that 3-phase transformer would go into some kind of a resonance / saturation mode where it started doing a very loud sing at 400 cycles with all of its higher harmonics, and of course it was drawing huge amounts of current during that period of time. And isolating the causative event when this would periodically happen was not easy. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Hey guys, I do appreciate that the things are going in the right direction. I really am very much thankful for your help. Okay, now I need to go to a little different subject, which is directly related to what I need. And I spoke to Glenn about it, and I thank you, Glenn, for all of the comments that he has made, but I would like to talk to you about that on the TechNet. Lighting job. Do you remember the electric fireballs that were that we see in nature? And Tesla was able to make them. Now, a few universities were playing with that because it is not really to achieve. And the Ohio, and Glenn mentioned also the California University were making the same kind of research. Now, the lab in Ohio, they had a slow wave helical antenna research, and they developed the equipment to produce electric fireballs, and they will last after the external power was removed, of course, for a certain period of time. Now, what they did is they used two mix of two frequencies. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, let me go to exact example. Okay, so they were following the Tesla instruction, and they rewired the apparatus as two synchronously pulsed high-power RF oscillators. The first at the frequency of 67 kHz. The second one at the frequency of 156 kHz. Although, they said that the exact frequency weren't very much critical. So the basis for the apparatus was at first conceived and patented by Tesla in 1897, the time when he was finished by J.P. Morgan, and then the idea of using two oscillators in synchronism was actually adopted. So they got enormous amplification, and the apparatus that was primarily two of one quarter wavelength. So the wave helical resonances above the conducting ground plane. Both of the resonators were magnetically coupled by the common link to spark up oscillator of the high peak power, approximately 70 kilowatts, and operating frequency 67 kilohertz. And the actual average power being delivered to the high voltage electrode was at the order of 3.2 kilowatts, which would stand for 2.4 megavolts RF, Tesla. So, of course, it was running 100 times the power which could produce with a very much modest equipment. And they were using 800 pulses per second. The duration was 100 microseconds. The low-frequency coil had a coherence of 72 microseconds. That means that the included incoherent oscillation of the resonators took about 72 microseconds to build up a standing wave or interference pattern and show up a high voltage on the top end of the resonator. The theory was developed in great details, and they have made a few referrals, and they state about 5, 6, 7 reference and 8.8 reference of their tutorial. Everything is documented. So the high-frequency coil had a coherence of time of about 30 microseconds. They were able to deliver the fireballs. They could last after the power was disconnected. Back to you, Dick.
I'm not quite sure what your question is, Wes.
Okay. Well, we're talking about a certain explosive nature of production of the fireballs. And using the frequency coil to arc the low frequency, using the high frequency coil to arc the low frequency coil, the low frequency coil would then release its energy rapidly in the burst. The burst of the energy released manifests itself in the shape of the ball bubble or bubble. Due to the fast voltage rise, the high frequency coil and subsequent short duration arc, the flow frequency coil and the flow, the low frequency sees a low impedance where it could normally see the high impedance. That is related to that what we were talking about, the transformer in Mapperstall situation, and I was actually doing exactly the same experiment. But talking about that particular experiment of Ohio, the energy trapped in the coil when the oscillator was on must now be dissipated very quickly at this lower impedance point as a burst. So, the same concept. Now, what we did is, I had two generators. One was oscillating on the frequency of 50 hertz, actually 47 hertz, and the other was, one was 373 hertz, kilohertz. And we've got an enormous in should say the explosive nature. Well, one of the ferrites simply popped around, popped to the pieces, but then we used this particular yoke, and it sustained. I mean, the creation of the fireball. That I would like to find out if you have any previous experience or know about somebody's experience in this area, or the that's why I was asking before. Was it possible that we have created a nuclear polarization? That's why I mentioned about the train of the impulses, and then there was no answer to it. I'm trying to get to this certain point with all of these findings, if you know what I'm talking about, Dick.
I think the lightning-caused fireballs were first experienced on ships out at sea during thunderstorms, and a few people have seen them on land, but they appear to be very rare events. The total number of people who have any experience with them and also have technical knowledge, I think, is very small. And all of the people I've ever talked to in 40 years of experience with engineering people, I've never ran into anyone who saw, understands, or knows how to generate electronic fireballs. Enough people have seen them. There's enough evidence that they do exist. But it appears to be a very rare event. And explaining what it is, I think, is very difficult. I don't know if I've ever read an explanation of what it is and how to make one. Let me ask John and Glenn if they have a similar experience. John first, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, absolutely no idea. I haven't got a clue. Can't help anybody with this. But Glenn will give us an answer, I'm sure.
Yeah, he's a fireball himself. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the right forum, though, for it, Dick. I mean, yeah, do I know how to do it? Sure do. The key to it is corona. You know, when you have an arcing, let's say if I were to create a generator, in a generator between that could create an arc across the spark gap, that's... You know, talked to a few people over at University of Ohio and University of Colorado. We kind of came up with similar, you know, findings on this one. I think you might have heard about my little spark generator I made there from a switching power supply. And I kind of, like, discussed it with a few other people, and what we kind of determined was that corona is really key. And if you have a generator that generates a tremendous amount of corona, which is basically a gas that gets... suspended within air, it'll actually create turbulent flow. Corona actually creates a tumbling or a tunneling effect through air. So it will actually ride like in little tubes or tunnels away from the source. So if you have a high voltage, approximately 5 microseconds or, you know, 200 kilohertz, with voltages between 100 k to 500 kV, you can generate a lot of corona and create a lot of these tubes. They in themselves will not necessarily create the fireball. Let me let it drop. What is interesting about corona is that, yes, it will travel, and you could get micro-arcing, and you at lower levels of energy across the corona, you can actually see colors, different, you know, most of the colors of the light spectrum, you know, the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, you know, you can kind of see it through different stages. But if you have enough energy and enough corona being developed, and then you create an air pressure difference, and that's where I think it gets sketchy with me. I don't know as much as people over in Ohio and in Colorado exactly. I mean, we went through a little bit of it, but there is a air pressure change that's required on the corona, and that does take place. Basically, the tunneling effect of that corona buildup can actually create quite a bang. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Okay, maybe I'm a little bit forgetful, Glenn, but I'm having trouble remembering when you told me about your corona generator. With your corona generator, You've seen colors of the rainbow, is what I think you're saying. Have you actually seen, even in miniature form, electronic fireballs, I guess they're called? Tell me what you have seen along these lines, Glenn. Go ahead.
What I've actually witnessed is that if I were to take this square wave generator, which is basically a secondary winding of a power supply, running at about 200K area, 5 microsecond pulses, and with a very, very large step-up coil on that secondary. There was no rectifier, just basically running it through a very, very large step-up Tesla coil, and with a wand at the end, basically stepping up the voltage easily into the 100 to 500 kV area on a very, very still summer's evening, and basically just energized this thing. I will start to see the corona tubes build up, and they'll change very, very interesting colors. And you can even unplug it, and you'll see these. They look like little miniature, like little lightning pieces coming off the end, tens of feet away from this wand. And interesting colors too. The predominant color I saw was more of like a greenish color. But did I ever actually create the actual fireball itself? No. But I'm quite sure that a lot of it has to do with a quick change in air pressure. I'm sure I wouldn't want to do that on a very, very windy day. It might give me some results I'm not prepared for. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Were you doing that experiment in Florida, or was that on Long Island?
I was playing around with that during the earlier part of the summer this year, actually, right here in Long Island.
You were doing this for fun, or was this part of a project?
No, this was just for fun, because I know Wesley was working with Tesla coils. And it was interesting what kind of voltages could be built up on a Tesla coil, you know, driving it with, you know, a secondary winding of like a 48-volt peak-to-peak secondary winding at, you know, about 200 kilohertz, you know, driving a Tesla coil. There was quite a step up from there. See what kind of an arc. So I set it up in the backyard, plugged it in, and much to my surprise, sure enough, I was getting some very, very interesting arcing coming off of it. And I was expecting things, you know, like a couple of inches, to see things, you know, arcing out, you know, tens of feet away from this thing. It was quite a surprise.
Yeah, run this by again. You and I have seen some of these YouTube videos where some of these guys have made super big Tesla coils that can make a spark jump numbers like 10 feet, maybe even 15 feet. And you've seen some minor 10 feet effect in your backyard. What's your guess as to how many watts at what frequency you were driving that with, Glenn? Go ahead.
I'd give a rough estimate, you know, rough guess by looking at a power meter, an AC power meter driving the primary of this. So the, you know, excluding inefficiencies and everything else, it was about 500 watts of wall power driving the power supply and then up through the winding. What the efficiencies are and everything, who knows. But I'd imagine it was 75%, but that's just a guess. But certainly, I don't believe it was lightning, Dick. I think it was just really corona. In other words, the arcing that was really coming off of in discussion with the people in the University of Ohio, basically what they were saying is that coil can generate corona, and the corona creates its own turbulent flow. So in other words, it will leave that coil and start moving turbulently through air away from there. And basically what I'm seeing is the glowing or the arcing of the corona tubes moving away from the from the Tesla coil.
I'm going to guess your Tesla coil had some kind of a large, round, torus-shaped metallic object on the top, and 10 feet away you were seeing corona. Wow. That's not easy for me to understand the mechanism of that one, Glenn. Go ahead.
It wasn't easy for me to understand either. And basically what they were saying is that the corona itself is charged. And because of each individual charged chunk of corona that's coming off the Tesla coil, it pushes the corona away and creates this turbulent flow. But as that corona is moving away, it's still charged and creates like a string or a chain from the Tesla coil and is far away and in many, many tubes. In other words, it wasn't just one little string that was arcing. There were many, like a tree of them coming off of this thing.
You've got this thing operational in your backyard, then you could give a demonstration on request.
I probably could, Dick, but let's put it this way. I was inside a glass-enclosed porch. This thing was about 15 feet in the back of the yard, and when I plugged it in, and I think that the first person I spoke to during the beginning of the summer this year was you, and I said, "Frank, Dick, do you think that this is possibly dangerous?" And you're like, "Yeah, I think so." So since then, I've kind of like unplugged it, put it away, don't really do it too much with it anymore. And I've been talking to a lot of people about it and getting a little bit more information on it. But as I said, yeah, I plug it in and turn it on again? But I'd like to know a lot more about it before I do any more playing with it, if you know what I'm saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'll be there with you in a minute, though, Wes. Glenn, your Tesla coil is how many feet high?
5 feet.
By my standards, that's a biggie. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, I believe that the phenomenon manifests itself when the coherence time is cut short. Could indeed be the some phenomenon that occurs in nature. So instead of having a short helical resonator that is that acts like a transmission line, the natural lightning stroke could be a full quarter wave transmission line with its own coherence time shortened by a small tumor at the end of the lightning stroke. So according to the lightning specialist that I spoke recently to, most of these small streamers occur as a top end of the lightning stroke, and this could account for the infrequency of ball lightning on the ground side of the stroke. There could be a dust, salt ashes, or other pollutants in the air near the lightning strikes that would or cause the or produce similar results. There is a certain confusion in this area, but the conclusion is that the fireballs are primary RF origin, not nuclear phenomena. And this is consistent with the Tesla observations. They can be produced either by the high current dumped into the hot air. So I'm satisfied that the phenomenon of the firebolt is produced by the sudden heating to high incandescence of mass of the air or the gas. As this case may be like the passage of the powerful discharge. You know, that's what I believe. It's a presence of resistively heated material masses. And then I'm going to go back to the subject of my experimentation. Back to you. Okay. I recall also the engine room fireballs produced by higher switches and relays. Before I go to my particular example, John, could you relate on the last part of my comment? Back to you.
As to what, Wes? I know what you said, but I don't understand the question.
Some kind of engine room fireballs, I name it this way, that are produced by switches and relays.
Well, I've seen a lot of sort of like the Jacob's Ladder display and a lot of markings, a massive amount of corona, but I've never actually seen the corona leave the substructure and radiate into the air. That I've never seen, but arcing, hopefully I've seen my share of it.
The arcing and the corona that you've seen, how many volts was involved? How long was the line that was generating it? Like, you know, was it many miles long and you were getting an inductive kickback? So how many volts? What color? How long? Can you give us a couple of words on some of the arcing, sparking, and coronas that you've seen, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.